live, more or less. Some days more, some days less. It's the Mike Novak Show. I've got a lot to talk about today, so we need to get right to it, which means as we come around, you all sing the song, and then I'll tell you what I have in store.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. And true currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in the main.
Thank you, Hillbilly Winos. And yes, that's really the name of the group. Welcome. As I said, a ton of stuff and very little time to do it. So let's get straight to it. The 11th Annual Good Food Festival and Conference happens March 19th through 21st at Chicago's UIC Forum. And it brings together consumers, producers, buyers, top chefs, experts, investors, farmers, all together to celebrate the fast-growing local and sustainable food movement. You're welcome. Everybody, come on by. Bring the family to this festival. There's all kinds of folks there. As I mentioned, more than 150 farmers, artisans, and other exhibitors. I'll be one of them. I'll be there. And you can learn from experts during chef demos and sessions such as design and grow an edible garden, artisan bread making with publican quality bread. There'll be a discussion on the future of food with media experts. If you're interested in gardening and environmental issues, check out the Good Food Commons, where the discussions are about DIY categories like make, grow, raise, preserve, compost, and community building. Do you want sessions like square foot gardening, good bugs, bad bugs, composting 101, workshops on canning, pickling, and more? It's all there. You can even sign up for an urban farm bus tour. Now, one of the great traditions of the Good Food Festival and Conference is the Localicious Party. It's on Friday night. It's one of Chicago's top annual tasting events where food from restaurants like Big Jones, Farmhouse, and Vera can be paired with some of the region's finest craft beer, spirits, hard cider, and wine. Speaking of Big Jones, my first segment today features Chef Paul Fehrebach, who is receiving the Good Food Chef of the Year Award from the festival. It's a fabulous interview. I hope you stick around for it. Not really because of me, because of Fehrebach. He's really interesting and a knowledgeable guy. And if you live in the Chicago area, here's what I'm going to do for you. I have tickets to give away for the Saturday Festival, which features family-friendly activities, food, of course, seminars, and a boatload of fun. In the old days, I would just take some phone calls. But now, the first 10 people to write to me at mike@mikenowak.net, mikenowak.net, will receive two passes for Saturday. So it's mike@mikenowak.net, and you'll get two passes, first 10 people to write to me. I'll have more to give away next week. So let's get to that interview with Chef Paul Fehrebach from Big Jones Restaurant in Chicago. Sitting in a restaurant in Andersonville isn't too unusual. There's a lot of great restaurants in Andersonville in Chicago. But this particular one is Big Jones on Clark Street in Andersonville. And I'm with Paul Fehrebach, who's the executive chef and co-owner of Big Jones. Paul, thank you so much for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
I've been reading about your restaurant. I have to admit, I have not been here. And I used to live in Andersonville for, back in the 80s, basically, wow. 80s and 90s. So it was quite a different stretch there. And I understand that I missed a big event here yesterday. What was going on?
We had a dinner with the Edna Lewis Foundation, and we had five absolutely brilliant African-American chefs. And a six-course dinner, and it was a great time.
So what kind of things did folks have at this dinner yesterday?
Well, we did some hors d'oeuvres. Kelly Stepto Royston, who's from Atwood Restaurant downtown, actually was our guest barkeep for the day. So she did some cocktails and wine pairings. We had stuffed chicken thigh with sweetbreads and jalapeno cheese grits. Had a crispy fried Mississippi catfish with a southern style hoe cake, a homemade pepper relish, bourbon glazed peach cobbler. There was Dwight Evans did a compressed oxtail with this.
Okay, stop right there. What's a compressed oxtail?
Well, that's oxtail is exactly what it sounds like, except for it's not actually from an ox; it's from cattle. The tail, which is a very high collagen part of the animal. There's a lot of gelatin in it, so you can braise it, and it makes was one of the reasons it's so highly prized for soup. It yields a lot of gelatin, which makes kind of a sticky sort of stock. But you can actually braise it and then cook the stock down, and there's so much collagen in the meat that you can actually pull it like you're shredding pork or shredding chicken for chicken salad, anything like that, and then you can press it, and it'll hold itself together because of all the collagen in the meat. So and then you cut it up into squares and or any shape you want, and then you can sear it to brown it, and you have sort of that flavor and texture of a really long braise paired with that flavor and texture of a really quick sear, where you get like the crispiness and all of the browning flavors. Really quite a treat.
Is this something that's regularly on the menu here, or was this special to yesterday?
This was each of the chefs brought a dish of their own, which was to reflect Edna Lewis's influence on them. Southern food has a very long and storied history, and I think that, you know, history is a funny thing because the history that we know was written by the people who got to write the history. And there's a lot of people who didn't necessarily get to write their own history, and it takes years sometimes, generations. And a lot of times stories are just lost forever. My friend Adrian Miller, who did the brilliant book Soul Food last year, is doing another book now on presidential chefs. And guess what? All the White House chefs from the beginning all the way through the 19th century and into the 20th century were African-American. And so really, and in the merchant homes and the plantation homes, believe me, the lady of the house wasn't in the kitchen doing the cooking. She wouldn't even venture into the kitchen, really. It was a hot, sweaty place. There were fires, big pots, cauldrons, and all of these sorts of things. And it was certainly very dangerous work, much more so than it is today. And, you know, so the people who were doing the work were African Americans. I mean, they weren't just in the fields, they were also in the kitchens. And so what we know today is Southern food, and certainly all of the iconic dishes, or most of the iconic dishes. If you get into Appalachian cooking, that's a little bit different a story, but certainly all of the iconic dishes that we think of in the history of Southern cooking, particularly.
For instance?
Well, if you look at something, if you look at grits, for instance, or chitlins, chitlins actually probably began in the Big House before they eventually became part of the soul food canon. A lot of the cakes and pastries, things like, you know, Marchand du Vin, which is, you know, my absolute favorite, one of my absolute favorite sauces in the world. It would have been created by African American cooks in New Orleans in the 19th century. And, you know, this is one of those sauces that takes 3 days to prepare and a really, really, really skillful eye to make a veal stock just so, and then to reduce it into a demi-glace and acquire the right kind of ham and acquire the right kind of truffles. I mean, this was sort of their domain, and to evolve this really sophisticated cuisine, particularly when you look at New Orleans Creole cooking, it's very international. It's very sophisticated, and it evolved in the hands and minds of African American cooks.
All right, so let's go back to Edna Lewis and the Edna Lewis Foundation. How were you honoring her at your event yesterday?
Well, what we want to do, first of all, is just raise awareness of her. And Edna Lewis has got is a very interesting story. And actually, in a way, she sort of embodies this question or this problem that we're faced with, which is the sort of the rewriting of American culinary history, or if not the rewriting of it, certainly the elimination of part of it, or the our ignorance of it. And that was Edna Lewis. She wrote in her book In Pursuit of Flavor, actually, she never took to modern industrial agriculture, modern industrial food. I mean, in the 1950s, post-war, you know, the American restaurant industry, which was still a very fledgling thing at that time, really took to the convenience of mass-produced, mass-processed, you have a hotel in New York and it's New Year's Eve, and let's go ahead and get asparagus flown up from Peru, and you know how great this is. And she never bought into that, and so all the way back from the 1950s, at Cafe Nicholson in New York, she was cooking farm to table seasonal food, and never really never bought into this other mindset that predominated amongst even the most prestigious American restaurants well into the 80s and in some cases into the 90s of, you know, we should source food from all over the world so that it's fresh, and fresh is the best thing. And I think we know perhaps that fresh isn't necessarily always the best thing. Bob Gardner on his blog, The Local Beat, wrote about 4 or 5 years ago, it's going way back, but it made a really strong impact on me, a blog post called The Tyranny of the Fresh. And it's a good thing that it's still there, and you know your listeners should go and look it up. It's a really great read. But
and Bob has been on my program before. I really like him and what he writes.
Yeah, that's cool. Very smart fella. But you know, so she never bought into this. She eventually wrote The Taste of Country Cooking in 1976. She wrote it, and it would have been written in 74, 75. It was in 1976 when it was published, and she sort of recounts the food ways that she grew up with in Freetown, Virginia, in the 1920s. And it's an absolutely fascinating book. The agrarian aesthetic in it is, I think, very universal for anyone who comes from an American farming family, certainly anyone from, you know, the Midwest, Great Lakes, or anywhere in the East or South. And it's laid out in seasonal menus, which really kind of blew my mind. Because this was before Chez Panisse and Alice Waters really started to do the seasonal farm-to-table thing. And so, you know, it's very interesting. And Alice Waters, I wouldn't say that she doesn't deserve her legacy. I mean, she's an extremely influential chef. But I think that it's something that she shares with Edna Lewis. And it's interesting to me that Alice Waters has become a household name, and I think deservedly so, as a phenomenally influential chef, whereas Edna Lewis isn't. But Edna Lewis was actually probably even leading Alice Waters in all of this stuff. And
so you're trying to correct some of that and call attention to what she did and how she paved the way.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would say correct exactly, but I definitely think that that's a part of all of our history and all of our heritage that we need to remember. And I think particularly being in the city. For a lot of African-American kids nowadays who are going to culinary school and who need role models and inspiration, I think that it's really important for them to understand that there is an agrarian tradition and an agrarian heritage that belongs to them. And I believe it belongs to all Americans as well. But, you know, when we look as individuals for role models, that Edna Lewis is someone that I think anyone can look to. But particularly young urban kids to think about. I mean, nowadays, the image of African Americans is a very urban thing, and she certainly lived. Edna Lewis certainly lived most of her life in the cities, but she grew up in the country, and that sense of taste never left her until she died, and she carried it with her through the various restaurants that she was chef of, and it certainly threads through all of her cookbooks.
We're talking to Paul Fehrbach, who is executive chef and co-owner of Big Jones. We're sitting in Big Jones on Clark Street in Andersonville in the city of Chicago. Well, let's finally get to your restaurant and your influences here. How did this get started, and who are the people who have influenced you?
Well, it's the restaurant here got started. I think I was spent a number of years at Shuba's back in the early 2000s, and while I was there, fabulous music venue. I mean, I saw probably 500 shows in 4.5 years that I was there, and some of the most amazing shows of my life were there. And they have a little restaurant that pairs with the music venue, and I was sort of running the food service end of things, more from a front of house perspective. But we didn't have a chef, so I was sort of driving the menus as well. And Shuba's at that time still, it's become more associated with indie rock now, but at the time it had more of a history with country, certainly very closely affiliated with a lot of the Bloodshot artists, so insurgent country, rockabilly, singer-songwriter stuff. And I thought that, trying to give the restaurant there a little bit more of an identity, I sort of thought that certain aspects of Southern food were a good fit. And I always liked what I knew about Southern food. It's certainly very similar to the food I grew up with in Southern Indiana. But I started reading and doing research, and it didn't take long before things really caught fire. I mean, I had always been interested in the cooking of New Orleans. When Hurricane Katrina happened, I sort of became, my preservationist mindset sort of became obsessed with South Louisiana's cooking. As something that I wanted to know more about and something that we needed to preserve, because, I mean, I think that we all believed that New Orleans was going to be rebuilt, but there were people who were saying that it shouldn't be, and there were a lot of question marks back then. And so I became obsessed with the cooking of New Orleans. I eventually read some books by Verda Mae Grosvenor, Vibration Cooking, a fantastic book for anyone interested in Southern food, which I read, and some books by John Martin Taylor, and I sort of started to realize that there was a whole nother regional cuisine over here. And I think that it's sort of like it was a revelation, because a lot of us who live in the north, even though I lived right across the river from Kentucky growing up, there was Kentucky, but you think of the rest of the south, it's just it's that big landmass down there. And it's not, it's a phenomenally diverse place, ethnically, racially, geographically. Every region of the South has its own historic cuisine. I mean, even if you go to Louisiana, there's probably three or four different distinct, like, little Cajun, just with the Cajuns, there's three or four little distinct areas. Some would argue more. Where the cooking is just a little bit different than it is, over down the road. And, of course, that's very different from the cooking in New Orleans.
So with so much to choose from, what part of that ended up at Big Jones here in Chicago?
Well, I try to select dishes, first of all, that are, when we opened, I wanted to do contemporary Southern, and, I wanted to create a restaurant, let's just drop this on King Street in Charleston or on Magazine Street in New Orleans, and that the locals would enjoy, and so we had a very contemporary approach to Southern cooking, and that presented a little bit of a problem, because we're not in Charleston and we're not in New Orleans, and again, a lot of Northerners have very narrow views of the South and very narrow views of Southern cooking, to which contemporary Southern doesn't fit. Because it's, everything is evolving and everything is changing. But it's also, we also have a lot of Southerners who would come here. And, for the most part, we can do a lot of different things. And people from the South, there's a lot of expatriated Southerners living in Chicago. They love it. And they understood it and they got it right away. But at the same time, they, a lot of times, are missing a taste of home. And that's why they're coming here. So, we sort of started to gravitate After a couple of years, more towards dishes that you would consider part of the traditional or historical Southern food canon, and without focusing on them so narrowly that the story of the South, which is this very broad and diverse place, gets lost. So, you know, we try to select dishes that, however obscure they are or however popular they are, we serve a lot of fried chicken. It's a very, very popular dish. You know, we serve a lot of boudin, which is a very obscure sausage from a particular part of Louisiana, undergoing a little bit of a revival right now. But that's a very, you know, boudin is a very particular thing from a very particular part of the South, and there's a story behind it. And that's what I love about boudin, aside from the fact that it's absolutely delicious. It's my favorite way to eat liver.
We're talking to Paul Fehrbach, who is the executive chef at Big Jones. And, of course, this is all coming about on my show because of the Good Food Festival and conference, which comes up March 19th to 21st. You're going to be receiving an award from the Good Food Festival. You're going to be participating in Localicious on Friday. And the award you're going to get is the Good Food Chef of the Year. Because of your commitment to sustainability, heirloom sourcing, that sort of thing, what is sustainability? A really overused word, as we know, but what does it mean in terms of your restaurant?
Well, first of all, thank you. And I was kind of blown away when Kim passed word to me that I was going to be given this award, because it's not, when you have a commitment to sustainability, it has nothing to do with awards. And also, when you become a chef, it has nothing to do with that sort of thing either. I mean, to me, first and foremost, sustainability means that you can keep doing something, and you can keep doing it, and the availability of resources around you and around the world doesn't really change. And when you're talking about food particularly, that's a really tough thing. Because most of the food that we eat has a huge impact on resources, and there's also a lot of groupthink involved in sustainability, the science behind it, the philosophy behind it, that a lot of times isn't entirely accurate. You know, for a long time, we thought that, you know, it was advocated that, you know, and as a lot of people still do, that we should eat a vegetable-based diet. Almost exclusively, and some people say vegan is the only way to be green. And the USDA is even thinking about changing its advocacy and saying that, you know, beef is just bad, for instance. And it's like, well, actually, beef is really bad if you talk about the way it's done in American agriculture. But if you talk about American agriculture as is promulgated by the USDA, which with the FDA's stamp of approval, with the Farm Bureau, the insurance companies, the banks, all of the crop sciences or life sciences companies, whatever the hell they call themselves nowadays, the chemical companies, none of that is sustainable. It is a process of extraction. And what is lost in American food that I think that we have to retain, and this got kind of going back to Edna Lewis, what I love about her books is the sort of the love that's behind it, and there's a sense of stewardship behind it. When you're making someone a meal, you're a sort of a steward for that person, and you're a steward for the land. But it's cultivation, and that's what we need to do. Is we need to cultivate a richer environment, and we need to cultivate a richer food culture, one that doesn't focus on extracting resources in order to produce cheap calories. We need to cultivate a better system. We need to cultivate the land.
You know, some people like the word regenerate when it comes to soil
a lot of the time that's absolutely the case. I mean, and then you have groups like the Savory Institute, which is, I think, savoryinstitute.org, if you want to read about, for instance, beef. And when a herd is managed correctly on the right kind of land, it can actually improve and restore marginal land. to go and use fossil fuels to grow feed, to feed them and to pipe water in, you know, from an aquifer in order to water them and then to ship them off somewhere to slaughter them. And then, you know, I guess now they're saying they're going to be able to fly the meat to China and have it processed and then have it come back. That's all extracting resources. Whereas if you cultivate the right system with beef, for instance, you can actually restore marginal land and you have a source of meat that's sustainable. You have a source of fat that's sustainable.
Let me interrupt for a second. What about fish? That seems to be particularly problematic in the 21st century.
Seafood is really difficult, and you know we serve only sustainable seafood here. But the definition of sustainable is different, and a lot of the times we find that populations that we thought were sustainable actually aren't, because I think there was a famous instance about, it's actually not famous, it's very obscure, about 4 or 5 years ago, a fish called the Hokey, which is...
I used to do that dance. It's the Hokey Pokey, right?
Okay. Yeah. Extremely abundant in the Pacific, east of New Zealand and north of New Zealand, and was fished and was going into, like, whalers and... what's the McDonald's fish sandwich called? You know, the filet of fish. And they thought that this fish is so abundant. It was actually Marine Stewardship Council certified, and everyone thought it was sustainable. And so they were just harvesting tons and tons of this fish. And then all of a sudden, like, they realized that the population was gone. And what they found out through their research was that the Hokie has a breeding cycle of 24 years.
Whoa.
Things like that become very important to consider.
You're pointing out it's our own ignorance that we don't know
right.
what
I,
we're
I
doing
would,
a lot.
Right, and I would actually say that with the Hokie, it's actually maybe an instance of where these third-party certification agencies, you could say, well, you know, the MSC, just they made a big mistake, and that's just horrible. And it's, you know, actually they caught it because they were monitoring the populations of Hokie, and because they were doing research, they were able to catch it, and it's going to take 24 years, you know, for the Hokie to fully recover. But it is going to recover, and so, you know, we follow the Marine Stewardship Council very closely. We follow the Shedd Aquarium very closely. We partner with them in their Right Bite program. We follow the Monterey Bay Aquarium very closely, and you know, it's very difficult because seafood is intrinsically an industry of extraction. You're going and you're taking something from mm-hmm. the ocean, or you're taking something from a lake. And if you do it at a sustainable rate, everything's fine.
The problem is we have that technology that we don't seem to have managed to control. And we can just take from the ocean, and we don't... It seems like we're not paying enough attention to just how much we're taking out.
Well, we're not, and aquaculture is a huge thing, and it's very problematic. There are a lot of aquaculture farms now that are promoting their fish as sustainable, and I will almost never believe them unless they're willing to tell me what they're feeding them, because there's a company called Omega Protein. That sells fish meal, actually also for pet food and a number of other things. But Omega Protein has giant trawlers out on the East Coast that go out and harvest hundreds of millions of tons of just little bitty fish every year. And it got to the point where the menhaden, which is this tiny little winnow-like fish, was severely threatened in a lot of places, and this is just being harvested to make protein to feed to other fish, to feed people. The problem is when you take the menhaden out of the water, the sea bass don't have anything to eat, the sea trout don't have anything to eat, and if they don't have anything to eat, sharks don't have anything to eat, and it creates this cycle of not of abundance, it creates a sort of a cycle of destruction and a cycle of starvation.
We're doing the same thing with our insect population. People worry about insect biomass on the planet because if you have insects, who feeds on insects? Birds feed on insects, other mammals, or mammals feed on insects, and it works its way up. It's the same
right.
thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually another interesting thing that I learned about. There's another phenomenal book if we want to talk about maybe being willing to change, keep our minds open and change how we think about sustainability, a book called Defending Beef by Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, who actually is a vegetarian, and she's been a rabble-rouser her whole life. But we have to understand that, again, if you're feeding beef on the range, or if you're farming, or if you're raising animals in a natural setting or a pasture-based setting, and you're managing your land correctly, beef cattle live and coexist amongst mice, amongst moles, chipmunks, birds, insects, what have you. As a source of calories on the right kind of land. I'm not saying we should put beef cattle all over the world, and it's not practical to feed everybody all of their calories with beef. It would take too much land. But as a source of calories, there's a lot of land where beef can actually benefit the land and can actually provide a source of calories in a biologically diverse environment. Whereas, again, if you're getting your source of calories from vegetables that are grown in the Central Valley in California, let me tell you something. There are gabillions, I mean untold numbers of mice, of birds, of insects, of little soil-dwelling creatures that suffer and die every year in the production of beets.
Beets,
you name it. Wheat, corn.
What about almonds? I'm beginning to wonder whether almonds are sustainable at all, because we take all these bees across the country to California every year, and then you hear things like it takes a gallon of water to produce an almond, and you begin to wonder if that's sustainable.
You know, I don't really think that it is. You know, it's just not. And you know, if we're talking about nuts as a source of protein as well, that because of for as a perfect example, there's all of these other ancillary. It's not just to say, well, you know, if you put beef, you know, beef consumes all of these resources. And it's like, again, if you do it the right way, it doesn't consume resources in an unsustainable way. Whereas something like an almond, which we could all say, oh, it's, you know, it's vegetarian, it's a source of protein, you know, this is sustainable. And it's like, well, actually, it's not. It uses a lot of water.
In a desert region, what is turning into a desert region, right?
In a desert region, they have their own pests that have to be managed in certain ways. You know, we're transporting honeybees all
right.
You know, it's an industry that just doesn't really make sense. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't grow almonds, but I am saying that if you got to water your almond trees to the tune of tens of thousands of gallons a year, you're growing your almonds in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, if you've got to truck in all sorts of grain to feed your beef cattle, you're growing your beef cattle in the wrong place. Everything has, you know, we need to be thinking about the right natural environments in which to be producing food.
Paul Fehrbach is the executive chef and co-owner of Big Jones. That's where we're sitting, talking to him. By the way, let me remind you that you can go to BigJonesChicago.com. If you don't remember that, go to my website, MikeNovak.net. It will be at this week's show. So what are you preparing to bring to Localicious at the Good Food Festival and Conference?
Ooh, boy, you know,
you haven't figured it out yet, huh?
I think what we're actually going to do is I've sort of been an obsession of mine the last couple of years is tamales, and that you know there's a very interesting history of tamales in the South, in the Delta region.
Now I have to admit right off the bat, you say is tamales a Southern food? I would say, well, it doesn't. If you count Mexico,
well, as actually, a certain kind of tamale is very Southern. The Delta tamale, Eastern Louisiana, Western and Central Mississippi. There's a particular kind of tamale that's made with cornmeal. It's like a hot water cornbread preparation, And they're smaller. They're like almost cigar-shaped. They're not nearly as big around as Mexican tamales. But they've been in the Delta region for years. And so I think we're going to do something with tamales in order for our vegetarian friends to be able to partake. We're likely to use, I think we're going to use some Genesis Growers pasillas. Pasilla chilies is the base, and we have some wheat lacoche from Three Sisters Garden, and probably some shiitake mushrooms from River Valley Ranch will kind of go into the filling. And as far as the corn, we're sort of on the fence whether we're going to make masa with Henry Moore corn from Anson Mills, which isn't local, but certified organic heritage corn, or if we're going to do the hot water masa or the hot water dough method with the Three Sisters Garden cornmeal that we use regularly here.
You're also doing a demonstration on Saturday at the Good Food Festival. I always love the Saturdays because it's madness there. I don't know if you're down there, but people are crazy and there's all kinds of stuff going on. So what do you think you're going to do a demonstration of?
There's a couple of things. We're actually going to prepare a meal. And we're going to do a dish called Old Virginia Fried Steak from my upcoming cookbook that's based on a dish from Mary Randolph's cookbook, The Virginia Housewife, from 1824. And so it's basically a kind of a veal schnitzel. And I want to do veal for a very specific reason, and that's that I want to talk about it. We'll use Strauss, which is a grass-fed, untethered, group-fed veal from which get to live with their mothers in Wisconsin. What a lot of people don't realize is that veal...
It doesn't... That's one of those words you say, the word veal.
And people think evil.
Yes.
Let me tell you something. Dairy herds, dairy cattle don't make good beef, and beef cattle generally aren't productive as dairy animals. So the way the dairy industry works, and whether you're using organic dairy or not, or local grass-fed dairy or whatnot, cattle have to be impregnated, and they have to give birth almost on a continual basis in order to produce milk. And so the dairy herd is giving birth to calves constantly, and about 51-52% of those calves are female and are kept for the herd, and approximately 48-49% of them are male. And they're never going to produce milk. And they're also, if they're grown to full size, not going to make particularly good beef. So, throughout for the longest time, I don't know exactly when this started, but it's long before our modern American cookbooks, those male births in dairy herds have traditionally been taken as veal. So if you're a vegetarian and you eat dairy, there are little male calves out there because of your dairy consumption. And that's something that I think it's very important for people to be aware of. So then the question becomes, well, we have these little male calves. How are we going to treat them? And what kind of lives are they going to have? Even if their lives are relatively short. So I want to be able to talk about that, and I'm not going to preach answers. But we do choose seasonally to serve some veal from Strauss in Wisconsin annually, because we serve dairy here. And if you're consuming dairy, you're because of you there are little male calves out there.
What about sourcing your fruits and vegetables? Do you try to do that as locally as possible?
We do it as we buy almost everything comes from the Green City Market vendors over the course of the growing season. Right now, March is the time of year that it's so hilarious that the Good Food Festival is in March, because it's the hardest time to cook in Chicago. It's also...
But if you're, the rest of the year people are actually out there growing
stuff.
Right,
for the community, it makes the most sense to have this event in March. But, so we're challenged, and I wind up using River Valley Ranch mushrooms, and Three Sisters Garden, freezes their... Their wheat lacoche when they make it in the summer and whatnot, and, so there's all of these things, but right now we have parsnips, we have carrots, we have beets, You know, we make all of our jams, jellies, preserves in the fall and summer when they're in season. So, you know, right now we're still serving all of that stuff. Was purchased locally from, we get most of our fruit from Seedling, not all of it. Right now we're sort of down to root vegetables. The Meyer Farms over in Michigan, we get lettuce from time to time. Genesis Growers comes up with lettuce from time to time.
So this changes your menu according, it's seasonal in that regard.
Yeah, it doesn't change it as much as I would like. You know, we still have collard greens, you know, and right now our collard greens are coming from farms in Alabama and Georgia. And we haven't really been able to, as a southern restaurant, get away from greens in the wintertime. You know, so there is that aspect of it. But it does change the menu. We do a lot more with grains this time of year. Mm-hmm. Right now we're using purple barley from Hazard Free Farm, which is the side dish we'll actually do with the while doing my demo next Saturday with the breaded veal steak. We do more things with we feature, you know, Kilgus's dairy more. We do corn-based preparations. All of our rice comes from either Anson Mills or Southern Brown Rice, which is in Wiener, Arkansas. A lot of people don't realize that there's a big rice industry in Arkansas. Southern Brown Rice is the oldest certified organic rice farm in the country. They've been certified organic since 1972, and we buy their brown rice through Natural Direct, which is one of the presenters at the expo.
Well, we could go on forever. You're a wealth of information. You throw out book names and information about different kinds of foods. And I would just advise people to come to Big Jones on Clark Street. What's the address again?
5347 North Clark.
As I said, if you want to check it out, you can go to BigJonesChicago.com. All right, the last question. Somebody comes in here for the first time. What are you going to tell them to order?
You know, at first I'm going to ask them what they like.
Well, that's smart.
And, you know, are they feeling adventurous, or do they want something really traditional? If they say, "Well, you know, I want some really traditional Southern cooking," I'm going to tell them to get a skillet of cornbread, and I'm going to tell them if they feel like seafood, order shrimp and grits. All of our grits come from Anson Mills in South Carolina.
My partner Kathleen is from Oklahoma. She loves grits. I'm going to bring her here to have some grits.
You should. They're certified organic. They all come from a handful of heritage strains of corn that Glenn Roberts and David Shields have, in a long-standing collaboration, they have resuscitated and revived. And Carolina Gourdseed White, I think, is the main one. But absolutely delicious grits. We use Laughing Bird shrimp. We also use American Gulf shrimp and Key West pink shrimp, which are sustainable populations. Or I'm going to tell them to get the fried chicken because that's,
why not?
That's always a good choice.
Yeah, yeah.
And with that, we actually have local sweet potatoes still too.
Great.
So they can get local chicken with local sweet potatoes. The greens, like I said, are coming from Georgia right now, but two-thirds of the plate's local there.
Well, as I said before, the Good Food Festival and Conference is at the UIC Forum, March 19th through the 21st. That's Thursday through Saturday. Saturday is, I like to think of it as the big party and everybody's doing everything. But there's a lot of other stuff going on, which I'm going to talk about on my show in the next couple of weeks. Paul Farabach, congratulations on your award. He's going to be receiving the Good Food Chef of the Year Award from the Good Food Festival and Conference. And if you want more information about that, go to goodfoodfestivals.com. Yes, there's an S on the end of it, goodfoodfestivals.com, to see all 3 days and all kinds of activities. Paul, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
Midwest Ecological Landscape Alliance is coming up with its annual conference on March 12th. That's going to be at the College of DuPage in Glen Ellyn. The title is Stepping Stones to Sustainable Landscapes. Now, as always, I have to issue a disclaimer in that I'm one of the founders of MELA, the Midwest Ecological Landscape Alliance. That doesn't mean I'm involved day-to-day anymore, and it doesn't mean that I don't value these wonderful conferences that they have every year. Sometimes there's more than one. This conference is going to be featuring Deborah Shore, who's a commissioner with the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago. I had her on my program last year to talk about storm water management. But she is just one of the people speaking there. And another is Dennis Dreher, who's with GeoSyntech Consultants. And Dennis and I met a couple of years back when we went out his way to talk about native plants in Lake County. What? No, was it McHenry or Lake?
McHenry County.
McHenry, yeah. That's what I thought. Okay, wow. Explain a little bit about GeoSyntech Consultants. It is a nationwide firm, as you say?
Yes, we're a nationwide firm. We address kind of a wide range of environmental issues and challenges related to soil and contamination and landfills and pipelines. The area that I focus on is more on the side of water resources, stormwater, flooding, water quality, and kind of coming up with innovative solutions, which is part of the focus of this conference, things like green infrastructure as an alternative to traditional gray infrastructure solutions to address some of these concerns.
Well, let's start right there then, because one of the things you're going to talk about is something called green infrastructure versus gray infrastructure. What's that all about?
Well, it's an evolving approach to address, as I sort of alluded to, stormwater problems, but also can have lots of other benefits. If I can give you a couple of examples, a gray infrastructure design for a parking lot is asphalt with curbs and gutters. It basically takes all the water and shoves it into a storm sewer. A green infrastructure alternative would be potentially permeable paving grid systems with bioswales and rain gardens with the intent of treating water more as a resource. So basically you literally soak up the water on the parking lot, put the vast majority of it back into the ground with very little coming up with stormwater runoff. So you reduce flooding problems, you reduce water quality problems, and at the same time, you're recharging local groundwater aquifers, so you're using that water the way nature intended. So that's one example. Another example might be replacing part of your turf grass lawn, which is typically very shallow-rooted, requires lots of maintenance and chemicals and water, with a native landscape of prairie vegetation, which is deep-rooted and doesn't require much maintenance, very few chemicals, and helps put the water back into the ground. At the same time, can attract butterflies and bees and birds and wildlife. So those are a couple of examples.
Yeah, I would argue with you, and this is obviously a subject for debate, that putting in a lawn doesn't necessarily require chemical use, although a lot of people do. I understand what you're saying, and I happen to agree with you that much better to go the native plant route. In fact, my slogan for lawns is when in doubt, rip it out and go native. But there are even ways that you can do natural lawn care and eschew the whole idea of chemicals. And I always encourage people to do that. I think it's crazy. This planet is in enough trouble as it is without us adding to it. And when you have backyards and you have hundreds of thousands or millions of backyards where chemicals are being poured in, it starts to create a lot of problems with water runoff and stuff, the non-point source that goes into our lakes and streams. And I imagine that's kind of what you're addressing here as well.
Absolutely. I mean, taking some of these practices down to the homeowner and business level is certainly one of the things we're going to be targeting. And kind of in the broader context of things, this approach of green infrastructure can be done at a regional scale. We like to argue it can be done at a municipal scale, but taking it down to a neighborhood scale or individual lot scale is really sort of where the rubber meets the road, and that's where we're looking to get more traction. And part of the focus of this coming conference that NEIL is hosting is to discuss opportunities and also, frankly, some of the challenges of translating some of these technologies down to those individual sites, because this is a technology that it's still relatively new. We're still learning, so we need to get a little bit better in terms of improving the predictability in terms of the outcome to make sure that our designs are going to work in the long term as opposed to, you know, just in the short term.
By the way, folks are interested in the conference, and not just the conference, because this people will be listening to this podcast in the future. Just go to melaweb.org to find more information, melaweb.org. Getting back to local neighborhood solutions, Dennis, how possible is that in an urban area? I can understand where folks in a suburban area might look at retention ponds and swales and that sort of thing to help mitigate stormwater damage. But in an urban area, which is already built up and has a lot of concrete and asphalt, how do you do it there?
Well, that's one of our evolving challenges. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned, you know, we're a national company. We do work in places like, for example, Akron, Ohio. That's one of our projects right now. We're also working with the City of Chicago and the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District to address issues such as basement flooding. In older developed areas, these are areas that typically have what are called combined sewers. So when it rains, the water goes into the sewer, it mixes with wastewater, and we don't have the capacity typically to deal with all that water for the bigger storm events. So what are some of the solutions? So just for example, we're looking at basically trying to, if you will, sort of soften up the landscape, make it more receptive to rainwater. So looking at things like permeable paving, which I mentioned before, bioswales, which is a newfangled way of describing something we used to call a ditch, but it's an alternative to a storm sewer, can be a lot less expensive, and the idea is to soak up some water, at least from the smaller routine storm events. One of the sort of evolving techniques that we're starting to look at in terms of its practicality and also cost is going back to what used to be used for collecting drainage off rooftops. So cisterns, for example, sometimes called rain barrels. So how much water can we actually capture, fresh water that's coming off of a rooftop, and then use some of that water for irrigation purposes, potentially flushing toilets, even washing clothes, to replace some of the demand that we're now, you know, taking in terms of using like Michigan water or pumping groundwater. Can we reuse that water in a productive way? So we're looking at some of these solutions, and obviously we have to look at the practicality, we have to look at the effectiveness, we have to look at the cost effectiveness, but some of the studies we're seeing show that these can be very practical alternatives, and frankly, things that local residents and business owners would actually gladly do if given the opportunity and the assistance in terms of how to design them and build them. So that's kind of the wave of evolution we're looking at right now in terms of taking some of these practices and looking at their practicality in urban neighborhoods.
Where does gray water come into this?
Good question. One of the challenges with, quote, gray water is, you know, our plumbing codes. Gray water, and again, I might get this definition off a little bit, but it's essentially water that comes from, say, washing your dishes or washing your clothes. It's the non-sanitary, if you will, or non-sewage components of water that we use in our households.
Basically, the stuff that's not going into the toilet.
Yes.
Or out of the toilet, I guess, too.
So one of the questions is, you know, can we reuse that water? And certainly in some other parts of the country where they're a little bit more, I guess, concerned because they have more significant water shortages, they've push that question a little bit further along in terms of coming up with solutions that are actually practical. It does require some, you know, challenging retrofits like maybe dual piping systems in our homes, But if that water can be reused, so for example, if you can reuse the water that comes out of your shower to flush your toilets, you're saving a lot of water that way. So that's kind of the direction we're going in, and this takes it a step further to say, what if we use the water that's collected on our rooftops and goes down our downspouts, collected in a rain barrel or a series of rain barrels and cisterns, and reuse that water in a productive way rather than flushing it into our sewers and our combined sewers and causing flooding problems and basement backups and things like that. So that's, again, the question we're evaluating right now.
You know, it's kind of ironic that folks who might question the use of gray water and say, well, you know, we shouldn't be putting this into our ground, might be the same people who will take potable water and use it on their lawns. It seems to me that's the real crime, is that we're taking drinkable water and using it to wash cars and to water turf. That seems the crazy part to me, not the other.
Yeah, it's a great point, Mike. And one of the things we've observed is to look at the annual water demand in many of our cities, and particularly in suburban areas where we have lots of lawns. Anywhere from 20 to 50% of the total water demand, and 50 is probably on the high end, goes toward watering our turf grass lawns. And as you say, is there a better way, a more effective way of using our water so we're not, you know, quote, wasting it for those kinds of uses? And in some parts of our region, many parts of our region, we really depend very heavily on groundwater, and that aquifer source is being overtapped, and so we have real legitimate shortages. So anything we can do to extend that water supply, reduce the demand, particularly when we're using that water, that precious resource, for things that could be supplied by other sources, those are all steps we need to start evaluating more seriously.
And another thing I'm sure you're dealing with, and we have just a couple of minutes here, is, as you mentioned, certain parts of the country are very sensitive about water use because they're getting drier. But because of climate change, other parts of the country, and actually Chicago could possibly be one of those parts of the country, could get wetter. We've had these crazy rainstorms in the last couple of years that dump so much water. You know, people are talking about 1 in 500 year events or 1 in 1,000 year events, which really make things difficult. So in different parts of the country, we're dealing with different water issues.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. We're seeing more and more. We have some very good experts in the state of Illinois who are translating some of the observations into forecasts. And you're right, what we're seeing is more extreme events. So, for example, what they're predicting is potentially more rainfall, certainly more extreme events. We're getting more 100-year events, even 500-year events. But at the same time, that rainfall isn't evenly distributed. So we're seeing drought conditions like we saw a couple of years ago during the summertime, which may get more and more severe. So to the extent that we can make our water systems more resilient, and resilient is sort of an evolving word, similar to sustainable, but resilient to changes in climate, resilient to the changes that we sort of impose in urban environments, the better off we're going to be. So again, that's one of the sort of central themes of our challenge toward finding better, what we're calling green infrastructure solutions, is to deal with that those changes in a more resilient way.
Well, if you're one of the people who likes to talk about these kinds of issues, you should show up at the MELA annual conference, Stepping Stones to Sustainable Landscapes, Thursday, March 12th, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the College of DuPage in Glen Ellen. Dennis Dreher, GeoSyntech Consultants, is one of the speakers. You can hear that he knows his stuff, and he's going to be there with Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago Commissioner Deborah Shore, and other folks like Christine Nye from the Shedd Aquarium, my friend who's working on sustainable landscapes there. More information at milaweb.org. Dennis, great talking to you again, and I'm going to see you at the conference.
Sounds great, Mike.
You can find more information about the Mike Novak Show at mikenovak.net. That's MIKENOWAK.net for links, photos, and commentary.